Economists study all kinds of things that can influence our financial decisions, but animal spirits.
Animal spirits are a term that are associated most with John Maynard Keynes, who is an extremely influential economist in how we think about measuring the aggregate economy and measuring business cycle fluctuations.
In this episode, how animal spirits affect the economy.
So Keynes thought that animal spirits were these instincts and emotions that influence behavior above and beyond rational thought or the calculations that people might be making about what to do in the economy. And he thought that this kind of primal urge that people had was the true culprit for why there were cycles of boom and bust. I'm Karthik Shastri. I am an assistant professor of economics and public affairs at Princeton University. And I'm a macroeconomist who studies broad issues related to business cycles, technological trends in the economy, and how they influence policymaking.
Karthik Shastri is also co-author with Joel Flynn of an article in the March issue of Finance and Development magazine about how storytelling can be used to better understand the twists and turns in the economy. Their research actually measures the spread of economic narratives to determine the impact they have on business cycles. So there is kind of a, you know, the traditional indicator for economists wanting to know what consumers are thinking or what's going on in the economy, essentially, from the consumer side, is this consumer confidence survey, which has been around since the late 60s. Why did you feel that you needed to dig deeper than that? I mean, what is the consumer confidence survey not telling us?
So, as you mentioned, since the 1960s, there have been a lot of these wonderful data sets that ask consumers how they're feeling about the economy in multiple choice telephone surveys. Hmm. We thought that there were kind of two reasons that it was important to move beyond that. The first is that, as you said, these consumer surveys are only targeting one part of the economy, which is consumers and consumer choice, which is undoubtedly really important, but perhaps not the whole story, even right, with respect to some of the original hypotheses that Keynes had, which were actually focused on the incentives in animal spirits that affected people in business. Mm-hmm. The second reason is that it's really just one of opportunity, that we actually have access to so much more information these days, textual information about economic decision makers, what they're thinking and how they're justifying business decisions. And we thought there was a tremendous opportunity to use this kind of more fine-grained and precise information where you could really target individual decision makers and individual businesses to paint a much more detailed picture of sentiments and animal spirits in the economy.
So this whole idea of economic narratives that you speak of in this article, and that is the basis for your research, I find it so interesting. I did recently a podcast with Yuval Harari, who is not an economist, but he's a philosopher and a historian. But his thesis on human evolution is that basically every decision we've ever made stems from believing one story or another. And that perspective can sort of help explain how people are united or divided on certain things. But what you're looking at in your research is really the inner workings of that process, you know, the nuts and the bolts of how people interpret these stories. So walk me through the process of dissecting these narratives that you speak of.
Absolutely. Well, first, I would just love to loop back to the very kind connection you made between some of the work that we're trying to do and trying to incorporate into macroeconomics and to some of the broader research that's out there in terms of history and human evolution. Mm-hmm. I also just like find completely fascinating the work that you speak of, some of the sort of cognitive psychology that's been pioneered by Joe Henrich. At Harvard University, just with the mind of thinking about how fundamentally humans are very social creatures. That's so critical to the lives we lead and the kind of the way in which we think and are able to accomplish so much. But that seems really deeply related to all to many long run phenomenon like what others have studied, but also these from short run phenomenon like cycles of boom and bust in the economy. So I just love that connection that you raised.
Yeah, but how do you actually do it?
So the first step is collecting data. And here, what we do is we take data on businesses in the United States and how they justify and describe their business decisions in two specific data sources. Their sales and earnings conference calls, which are going on every quarter. That's Q&A with investors and analysts about business performance and how and why it turned out that way. And the forms 10K and 10Q that firms submit to the Securities and Exchange Commission, which have broadly the same flavor. We take these data, which are really kind of a goldmine of unstructured information about not just what businesses have done, but how they're thinking about it. And then we apply natural language processing tools from which we can extract features like the sentiment of this text, which is really important towards some of the hypotheses we want to study, and also the more specific granular topics that are coming up in discussion, which are candidates, if you like, for the narratives that Shiller and others have talked about that are potentially rampant in the economy and spreading contagiously. So the first step is really to kind of measure what a narrative is in a very precise way that we can link with individual actors in the economy. The second step is to try to measure whether narratives have the properties that people have hypothesized, including Shiller, give them so much power. And these properties are that they influence decisions and that they spread contagiously through the economy. And here we use empirical techniques using our fine-grained data that can associate narratives with a specific firm at a specific point in time to measure that first, firms that are adopting optimistic narratives really seem to be acting on it. So that is to say, if you compare two firms that in all fundamental attributes look the same in terms of, say, their size, their productivity, their clip of hiring and financial returns in the recent past, a firm that's adopting an optimistic narrative hires 2.6 percentage points more per year than the comparable company that we can identify in the data. And moreover, and really strikingly to us, these effects are completely independent from the financial performance of the firm, and they don't seem predictive of future positive performance for the firm, which is kind of in line with a certain reading of Keynes's idea here about irrational animal spirits. That is, it really looks like firms seem to catch this bug from a variety of forms. They go out on a limb and kind of do something acting on their optimism, but it doesn't exactly portend future success for them. And same too for pessimism in the other direction.
Okay, so I'm going to back up a little bit here because what fascinates me is how you can take all the data from these conference calls and from these financial forms that corporations file. How do you actually, you know, turn these things into something that you can recognize as a narrative?
That's a fantastic question. We actually use three different methods that kind of trade off, if you'd like, how precise we can be ex ante about what we're looking for and how much we let the data speak directly, I guess, about what narratives firms are entertaining. So on one end of the spectrum, kind of the most conservative method that we use by some definition is sentiment scoring of documents. So that's a really old technique that has a lot of precedent both in academic research and in more practical application by investors, for example, where you take the language in a document and you score it based on its positive or negative tone, making corrections for the fact that what seems like positive or negative tone in everyday conversation isn't exactly the same way that you'd identify it in the financial document. And we use techniques that are kind of borrowed from a long tradition of academic study to do that correctly. The second method kind of gets even closer to some of the specific hypotheses that Shiller advances. So in Robert Shiller's book, Narrative Economics, he advances the hypothesis that in the United States, in recent history, there are 9 perennial economic narratives, which cover topics as diverse as the rise of alternative currencies like the silver standard in the early 20th century to Bitcoin today, to the rise of artificial intelligence and robots that are going to transform the labor market. And he argues that these 9 perennial narratives are the ones that recur most in American financial history. So our second method tests that exactly by kind of training an algorithm on the way that Shiller describes his own perennial economic narratives. What are the key words and phrases that characterize those stories? We search the documents of firms to see if they're talking about exactly those topics and to see how that seems to evolve and influence decisions over time. Finally, one thing with the methods I described so far is that they're based on maybe the conceptions of narratives that we have as researchers, but we don't necessarily want to do that because we don't know ex ante what are all the fine-grained narratives that firms are talking about, and we might miss something because we didn't think about it ahead of time. So to address that, we use a third method from natural language processing called the latent Dirichlet allocation model, which is a way, basically in an unstructured way, of looking for groups of words and phrases that reoccur in the conference calls or the text of many different firms. And then the data speak directly about these topics that lots of firms seem to be discussing.
That's fascinating. So I guess the next step is to understand how these stories are actually disseminated. And you speak of, in the article again, you speak of how these narratives essentially spread like viruses at times. So how does that happen? And how do you determine the actual impact of these contagious stories as you describe them?
So the second kind of key hypothesis that's out there about narratives, and you hit the nail on the head, it's in some ways the most compelling, is that they're out there spreading like viruses in a way that's related to social dynamics and really just how captivating these stories are. So what we can do in the data is, because we have a panel data set on individual actors in the economy, what narratives they entertain today and what narratives they entertain tomorrow, we can directly test that narratives are spreading across firms. And what we find is that narratives are contagious in the data at the aggregate level. So that's fully consistent with this idea of animal spirits. Holding fixed the fundamentals in the economy, if more firms were optimistic yesterday, more firms are going to be optimistic in the future. And moreover, there seems to be like a very intuitive network for how narratives spread in the economy. As you zoom in on finer and finer units, like individual industries or groups of firms that are more narrowly determined peers, according to investors, you see the spread of narratives is really concentrated by those close-knit firms. And we think that's really suggestive that there's kind of more social tissue connecting firms that are more closely linked with one another in the economy.
And so given how contagious these narratives can be, is there anything in the data that suggests that these could be self-fulfilling prophecies?
It's a really good question. And that's kind of one of the main findings that comes out of our quantitative analysis when we pull all of these empirical findings together and interpret them through the lens of a macroeconomic theory. So what we find is actually quite nuanced. And I think the glass is, well, I won't say what's full or what's empty from a purely normative perspective, but there's elements of which what you said are exactly right and elements which we could actually rule out based on the data. So what we find is that composing together these two facts, that narratives are contagious and they seem to affect individual decisions, that they have a pretty strong force amplifying the business cycle. Our bottom line calculation is that narrative fluctuations explain about 20% of the U.S. business cycle since 1995. And more specifically, they seem particularly important for explaining the boom and bust in the early 2000s with the run-up of the stock market and then the dot-com crash, as well as the Great Recession of 2008 and 2009, which was kind of widely related to a huge amount of narratives of a pessimism that took hold very, very quickly in the U.S. economy. So as an amplifying force, narratives seem really, really strong. When economic performance is very good or very bad, even in a transient way, it seems like narratives catch hold and make economic fluctuations more persistent than they would have been otherwise, in a way that is, from a certain definition, self-fulfilling. One thing that we show in the paper that we can rule out is this stronger phenomenon that we call narrative hysteresis, which is this theoretical possibility that narratives are so self-fulfilling, they lead to essentially permanent changes in the economy. That is to say, we show a sort of a sharp theoretical condition that obtains in our model that if narratives were sufficiently contagious or sufficiently impactful on the economy, we might have something that looked more like lost decades, where pessimism catches hold and really mires the economy in a trap at the timescale of decades. And while we wouldn't rule out that that is a good explanation for phenomena, you know, in other contexts, in the United States, based on the data that we have, the potentially good news is that narratives don't seem strong enough to have those kinds of extremely long-lived effects.
Wow. So what does all this tell us about how businesses operate, essentially? I mean, you know, are sound financial decisions based on fundamentals, as we've always been led to believe, or is it much more nuanced than we thought?
You know, one thing that comes out of analysis like this is that because of the self-fulfilling and social aspect of narratives that affect the economy, responding a little bit to the narratives that are out there potentially is a sound business decision. And I think, you know, a lot of business decision makers would say the same. Because of market forces, because of the way companies are compared against each other, and because of the fact that you want to ride the business cycle a little bit, it's not necessarily a completely irrational idea to go a little bit with the crowd. That said, what our analysis seems to suggest is that a lot of what firms are doing at the individual level, at least from the vantage point of outside measurement, looks like overreaction. And that, you know, perhaps is just a deeper consequence, going back to some of the points you raised earlier, Bruce, a deeper consequence of, you know, the social factors that drive decisions. And I have to say, feels very consistent with the original hypothesis of Keynes about the animal spirits that drive decisions.
That's great. And so when we look back to the various economic episodes that we've experienced, you know, in the past few decades, this tool, I mean, does it reveal anything that we didn't know about how crises sort of evolve? I mean, can you use this to kind of reverse engineer how a crisis may have unfolded, and might it help avert economic downturns in the future, do you think?
One thing that the analysis reveals about crises in the past is that a lot of the persistence of how, say, events like the Great Recession, the early 2000s recession, affected the American economy is really coming from these psychological factors, you could call, about the narratives that are circulating in the economy and how they seem to have a medium-run depressive effect on investment, on hiring, on economic activity more broadly. So by casting the focus on narratives, we think our analysis gives a sharper sense to policymakers of what might be important and what dimensions it might be useful to intervene. And we think that our study is only really the beginning for a more nuanced exploration of how policymakers can control the narrative and try to directly influence these phenomena. I think a second point, which is related to points you raised earlier, Bruce, is purely in terms of measurement, where we think that, you know, maybe our analysis highlights something different and empirically quite important that policymakers could monitor in real time to get a more precise understanding of not just how the whole economy is doing, but how specific pieces of the economy, which might be more or less strong echo chambers for certain kinds of narratives.
And so finally, I hate to even bring this up because it seems to be upstaging everything these days, but what happens when AI and not corporate execs or people are driving these narratives? I mean, it's a bit of a scary thought, given what you've just told us about the degree to which people and businesses are influenced by these stories. But do you have any idea what impact AI will have on animal spirits?
That is a fabulous question, and I think one that could have a really big footprint on how the economy operates and how the financial sector operates in the coming decades. I have a few thoughts that I would say kind of haven't yet been reflected in the academic research that my collaborators and I have been doing on this, but it has sort of come to my mind as important topics for the future. The first is that I find it very hard to predict whether AI is more or less prone to animal spirits than people, actually. While there is this instinct that, well, the AI is a robot, it's making some cold and calculated decisions, the most recent trend in AI are these large language models whose entire modus operandi is to take large-scale databases of text and to imitate it. You know, the mode of success for a large language model like ChatGPT, which, you know, has become a little bit more commonplace in everyday life, or even, you know, the little AI suggestions that show up on Google searches now, its goal is to try to imitate exactly what it's picking up everybody else talking about. And if anything, that sounds like the biggest possible seeding ground for narrative contagion. And so too, if on the other side, there's a lot of AI tools being used by investors to pick companies that are winning and losing and kind of going with and against trends. So even though AI are robots, I'm actually not sure that they're any less prone to animal spirits. And there's a decent argument that they're more prone to animal spirits. And that's definitely something to think about. It could really affect how a lot of these phenomena play out in the future. That said, you know, in an AI-driven world, maybe the types of narratives that people entertain will change a little bit. And, you know, the essence really of what makes a story a good story is going to change from, you know, certain human impulses that people have. They're looking for characters and heroes and villains and things like that that resonate more with our culture, versus the AI could, by chance or by the design of the algorithm, be picking up different sort of fundamental factors that make narrative stick. So, I mean, that's all to say that what you or I think makes a story good may or may not be what the AI thinks makes a good or bad story. And that's kind of interesting, actually.
Yeah, very interesting, I'd say. Fascinating research. Karthik Sastry, Assistant Professor of Economics and Public Affairs at Princeton University. Congratulations on this great research, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Look for Karthik Sastry's article, How Animal Spirits Affect the Economy, in the March issue of Finance and Development magazine. Go to imf.org/FND. And look for other IMF podcasts on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. You can also follow us on X. Our handle is @IMF_podcast. I'm Bruce Edwards. Thanks for listening.